history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories out there waiting to be told if we'll ask a few questions and take that time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a whole lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I'm excited to hear the story today from 96-year-old Del Schvichtenberg in Carson City, Nevada. What a story this is, and I'm trying to figure out where to start, Del, whether what you've been through in the last year, you're a walking miracle, or the fact that you were a pilot before you turned 16 years old, or all through World War II in submarines. I guess let's start growing up. Tell me about your childhood in the Midwest.
Oh, I was born in Becker, Minnesota. My parents were potato farmers, and they had quite a drought, and over several years, and lost the farm. And we moved to Illinois, and so actually, from 2 years on till 18, when I went in the Navy, I was a resident of Oswego, Illinois. And graduated Oswego High School, a class of 18.
Now, you're 96 years old, and you just spouted off memories from the 1920s. A year ago, could you have done that? I mean, a year ago, you had, what, 30 staples in your head?
Well, at that particular point, I don't think so.
You're a walking miracle.
I had bad dreams, too.
Well, we'll stick with the 20s and 30s here for a few minutes. So growing up there in Oswego, Illinois, what kind of dreams and ambitions did you have as a child?
I worked in a garage all the way through high school, a garage and gas station combination for Mr. and Mrs. Ted Sickler. They were very kind and good people to work for. And when I graduated high school, unemployment was 25% at that time. Jobs were just not there. So I went to the recruiting office, and in 2 weeks, I was in the Navy.
Well, and even before that, I don't think most teenagers during that time period can say that they were pilots already. Where did this dream of flying come from?
I paid for by working 12 cents an hour. I could rent a plane for a half hour for $3. And Joliet Airport, it was $6 an hour with the instructor. Well, I built model airplanes as a kid. I always had an interest in it. So I put in many hours trying to get my solo license, and I finally did.
How old were you?
16. 2 weeks before I was 16. And Joliet Airport is sort of right next to a golf course and a highway. In order to land in Joliet Airport, I had to sideslip the airplane over the wires in order to get down onto the airfield. At one point, there was a pilot taking off underneath me. I veered off and saved the airplane and myself, and after that, the instructor, I could do no wrong.
Sounds like you were a natural. So when you sign up for the Navy a couple years later, were you thinking you might be a flyer in the Navy?
No. I had taken a night school for United Airlines mechanic. For an apprenticeship, I had about 5 months left of high school before I could go to work for United. So I finished high school, and then I went to United in Chicago. Here I am. When can I go to work? Well, it's not quite like that. The FAA came into being And you must be a third-class mechanic in order to go to work. No more apprenticeship. And there's two schools, St. Louis, then there's Boeing in Seattle. So I went to St. Louis, and I checked on the school, and when it wound up to be something like $3,000 and $4,000 in depression time. My mother was working to pay off doctor bills by cleaning the doctor's offices, and my dad was a night watchman at a gravel pit, and then he did hauling during the day. Gravel, and in wintertime, coal. He would go to the coal mines and pick up loads of coal.
So you thought you're going to go to work for United. That didn't work out, and the Navy was your next best thing. But did you know that a war was coming? Did you have any idea that you might be at war in a year or two?
No, but I didn't know anything about submarines. So that's the reason I chose submarines over aviation.
And that was something you had to volunteer for, to be in subs.
Yes.
What possessed you to do something so crazy? Did you know how risky it was, how dangerous?
No, not really. Before you get into submarines, you got back to New London sub school, and you talked to a psychologist. If you got past him, then you had to go through the tank with months and long making a send up a rope. In order to start that, you were in quite confined space of maybe three or four people in this little compartment off of the tank. You got past that, then you got to go to school. And there was a dropout rate of about 10%, something like that. Then when you got aboard a submarine, you had to qualify. And what qualifying means is everybody had to do it another man's job. You had to be able to fire torpedoes, you had to be able to start the engine, and you had to have a notebook and the drawings of all the systems. Then you would go through with an officer, usually the executive officer of the submarine. And if you got past his questioning as you went through the boat, why, you got qualified. And at that time, you had a embroidery insignia on the left arm. Then later on, during World War II, they went to the silver and gold pins.
Well, and speaking of World War II, everybody seems to remember where they were on December 7th, 1941. You're already in the Navy. Where were you at that time?
I was at New London on the USS 06 school boat. We were taking out students once in the morning and once in the afternoon. Because the school is sort of a hands-on between classroom and submarine. And the 06 was not anywhere near like a fleet boat, which was being made for World War II.
Well, and I want to hear about the 06, but do you remember that day, December 7th, and how you found out and what that created in that atmosphere there in New London?
Yes, I didn't remember what I was doing. I was helping the chief wash his car. Was on a Sunday. All at once, the radio started to blare out the news that Pearl Harbor was being attacked. Of course, we all had to go back to the ship and wait for instructions. That was about the atmosphere. Anybody that was on a ship and the school had to stay in the barracks.
Is that something that weighed on you? Did it change your perspective or trigger some emotions to know that now you're going to be at war? And who knows how long this is going to last?
Not really. You had a job to do, and you were going to do it.
And eventually you'd be making war patrols on these World War II subs, which are a far cry from the submarines we have today. But you're talking about that boat that you're training on in New London, the 06. And this is a submarine constructed during World War I?
That is correct.
How primitive was that? How much of a chasm in technology is there there?
It was very much like the German U-boats. Very simple, basic. in principal. Then I volunteered for new construction, and that was when I went to the Sand Lance.
And before you went on the Sand Lance, you got a firsthand understanding of how dangerous a submarine life could be. You guys are training with some other older boats, and there was an accident there.
When we made a 200-foot dive, the 06, the 09, and the 010, and they dove in rotation of the commanding officer seniority. The 010 made the first dive, the 06 made the second dive, and the 09 made the last dive. And then, of course, the 09 never came up. So we had an audible oscillator that we kept calling for several days, trying to get a response. The submarine rescue vessel out of New London came up and a diver went down, and the 09 was crushed amidships, and they tapped on the hull and didn't get any response. About two or three days later, the Secretary of the Navy came up and declared it a sacred tomb. And it was in 438 feet of water at that time. Now it's moved out to about 1,200 feet or more.
And there are 28 sailors still entombed on it?
Oh, yes. A diver could only do about 10 or 15 minutes at the depth, and then it took them hours to decompress coming back up.
And I'm guessing, now this is just a guess, I'm imagining that you probably knew a fair amount of those 28 men.
Yes, most of us were either in the class or lived together in Philadelphia when we were recommissioning. We lived above the reserve barracks, and so we got pretty close together.
So these are young men just like you, and before they've even gone off to war, they've lost their lives. How did you handle that? That's got to be really tough to deal with.
Well, it was, and it's very similar to sinking Japanese ships. You think about the amount of lives that were lost.
And I don't want to linger too long on this situation, but you lose a whole boat and 28 men, and it's a sub just like yours. Is there a thought that goes through your mind, hey, that could have been me, or that could be me in the future?
Oh, yeah. You probably lost a couple nights' sleep.
And you haven't gone off to war yet, but there's something that you did before your first war patrol. You got married. What was that all about?
We'd been going together in high school. My mother was in the hospital, actually, and I went back to see her, and in 5 days, got married and had to drive back to New London. The priest had to go to Chicago, got a dispensation in order to marry us. We got to the church, and the license was home on the piano. So we got married quite late in the evening. Then almost immediately had to leave for New London. Then I reported into New London, and then we had to find a place to live. And we lived in Norwich, Connecticut, in a home. This lady had lost her husband. We had kitchen privileges and a bedroom and a bath. This lady's washing machine didn't work. Her vacuum didn't work. In our bedroom, we had pieces of washing machine and vacuum cleaner. And I'd order parts, and as the parts would come in, I'd put it back together. It was an Italian lady. Her name was Ferry. They had a grocery store at one time. But anyway, she was a nice lady.
Well, and I'm thinking I probably know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. I guess if you got married without even knowing where you were going to live in New London, you probably didn't think it through to consider, hey, I'm marrying this girl, but I might not come back home to her. I'm going off to a war that could kill me. Did that thought at all enter your mind that there was a chance she was going to be a young widow?
Yes. but she was willing, so, and she lived with her mother during World War II. And of course, mail service wasn't too good. It was about every 2 or 3 months she would get a letter, and that letter would be censored before it left the ship. So there wasn't much you could write.
And as we start to dive into some of the stories you have from submarines during World War II, maybe we should underscore for people just how significant this danger was. I know you used to be a docent on the Pampanito there in San Francisco, which people can still visit and get a taste of a World War II sub today. Maybe there's some people listening right now who saw you there and heard from you the statistics for submarines in World War II. How many were lost, and what a big percentage that was of the guys who actually served on subs.
Well, to start out, the submarine force was less than 2% of the Navy. We sank over half of the Japanese fleet, and we lost 52 submarines out of a possible 249. Roughly 3,500 men were lost on the 52 submarines, and some of them died in prison camps. So, and I don't think we have a good figure of that.
Of how many died in captivity?
In captivity.
Well, and I know there are some points in your story where you came close to joining those 3,500 who never came back, and you probably weren't too far away from potentially being a POW either, with one story I know we're going to hear if you didn't come through and do what you did to earn the Bronze Star. But what about the capabilities of these subs and the limitations of these submarines as far as how long you could submerge?
We would be submerged all day. We'd have to come up at night in order to charge batteries and charge air, because we had 5 air banks, and so those 2 air banks would have to be charged that night. When we would go on patrol, we'd have 24 torpedoes on board. We'd have roughly 2 to 3 months' stores on board, and when we got rid of the 24 torpedoes, that was the end of the patrol. And so sometimes we would be out there almost 3 months and get pretty short of food and supplies and even fuel. Now the fuel, we carried enough fuel to go halfway around the world, 11,800 miles of diesel fuel. Sometimes we'd come in, we'd have maybe 500 gallons left.
We're starting to get the picture, and we'll hear more about what Del Schvichtenberg did aboard that World War II submarine when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.